This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Martha is gone. Tom is gone in 60 seconds. And the rest of the GOP is piling in a car and heading down to the casino like a couple of teenagers in a Springsteen song. That's just a bit of what we'll be talking about today in The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. We'll also consider a new state ad campaign that touts the job creators. And with a week to finally read the legislation that passed at the end of the session, I'm sure our Capitol insiders will be able to tell us what is law and what is not. I sure hope they address the glass eel situation. Joining us, as always, is Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Hello, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Joining me also is Mark Pazniokas, Capitol Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror. Hello there, Paz.
Good morning.
And Daniela Altamari joins us. She's State House reporter for the Hartford Current, and she writes the Capitol Watch blog. Hi there, Daniela. Good to see you.
Hi.
If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. You can email wherewelive@wnpr.org. You can also tweet us at wherewelive. We're going to be starting, though, talking about the state party conventions, which are coming up this weekend. The Democratic convention, as Paz put it, a bit more of a coronation than an actual convention. The GOP does have an interesting convention, though, and we want to bring into the conversation someone who knows a little bit about that party and has some things to say about it. Lowell Weicker is former governor and former U.S. senator, and he joins us by phone. Good to speak with you once again, Senator. It's John Dankosky, and this is Where We Live. Thanks for joining us.
John, good to talk to you.
I want to just ask you first about what you think the state of the GOP in Connecticut is broadly. As you watch from the outside, what do you think?
It's irrelevant, and that's a big problem for the state of Connecticut because, quite frankly, I don't think one party rules, you know, can bring any good to the governings of the state of Connecticut. You know, I'm not here to go ahead and endorse candidates or endorse parties, but I do know one thing. You have to have two contestants in the ring. And right now, the Republicans are just not there, or as Connecticut Magazine has on their cover, the elephant not in the room. So that's really the overall observation. Now, there's much that has to be done about it. And I really shouldn't be speaking for it, because this is a party that booted me out and has booted every moderate out. But I also like the state of Connecticut, if you will, or that's dominant in my thinking. And I know we need a vibrant Republican Party contesting the Democrats in order to achieve that.
You know, Senator Weicker, this is Colin McEnroe. One thing that we've seen is, if you go back kind of a generation in politics, not a real full generation, you can look around and see some Republican office holders and candidates who kind of came up through the ranks and demonstrated a certain level of civic engagement. So you've got Nancy Johnson, you've got Chris Shays, you got Rob Simmons. You've got people who served in the legislature, moved up from there. Now, the last few cycles, we've seen Linda McMahon run twice. We've seen Tom Foley run once, and he's about to run twice. If you go over to the 5th District, we've got Mark Greenberg, who seems to be the prohibitive favorite to run against Elizabeth Esty. These are all people who don't have a lot, any really electoral experience in their past. Is that part of the problem? I mean, it seems to be a model that the voters are not reacting well to. When you say irrelevant, is this part of it?
I think it's part of it. I mean, that's the same history that I have, having come through the legislature and into the governor's chair. But I think most important are ideas. And the fact is that there's too much philosophical emphasis on the candidates that run for the Republican Party. You've got to address the demographic that is the state of Connecticut. This is a state that is urban. It has lots of poor, blacks, Latinos, women, gays, disabled. I go right down the list. And those constituencies are not being addressed, and therefore you can't win the state. You know, a southern strategy does not work in the state of Connecticut. We're not a religious right state. We're not an anti-labor state. So I think it's more the understanding of what comprises Connecticut that is necessary. Obviously, experience is a good thing to have, but more important are the ideas that are put out there.
Governor, I just want to ask you a question, though, about that. I mean, you're saying the Republican Party's irrelevant. They came within a hair's breadth of losing the governor's seat last time around. You know, they'd won many times before. I don't think we've seen a religious right candidate from the Connecticut Republican Party in some time. Linda McMahon certainly wasn't one. I don't think Tom Foley was one. So I'm just wondering if you can sort of expand on that a little bit.
Well, yeah, I suppose the best way to extend on my observations is it's been over 30 years since the Republicans elected a statewide candidate. I think with the exception of a corrupt Republican governor, I think I was the last one to go ahead and do that. So something's missing here. And the bottom line is winning. I'm not interested in moral victories or philosophical victories. It's ballot box victories that matters. And again, I have never pleaded the cause for the Republican Party, but I realize that somebody should, but it's absolutely necessary that they start winning some offices and bringing balance to our government.
If they take the direction you're talking about, and Tom Foley is at least paying lip service to that kind of approach. He's talking about an urban campaign. He's talking about broadening the base. If they take that approach, what would be the difference between Republicans? What would be a Connecticut Republican versus a Connecticut Democrat?
Well, first of all, you've got a lot to discuss as far as the Democrats. The Republicans have a lot to discuss as far as the Democrats are concerned, because this one-party rule has been a fiscal mess. I mean, the amount of money that's owed and the amount of money that's spent, boy, is that ever an issue. So there's one very clear difference. I mean, I always thought that I and the moderate Republicans on the national scale, we were fiscal conservatives and social liberals. And I think that's the key to the Republicans' comeback, because I see nothing in the way the state has been run financially that gives me a great deal of enthusiasm as to the Democratic Party.
We're talking with Lowell Weicker, Connecticut's former governor and former U.S. senator, and we're in the Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable, talking a bit about the GOP heading into the state conventions this weekend. Joining me, as always, is Colin McEnroe from the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Danielle Altamari joins us from the Hartford Current, and Mark Pasniokas from the Connecticut Mirror. Colin, as the senator there is talking about irrelevancy, he and you discussed the candidates that they've run, people like Mark Greenberg, Tom Foley, Linda McMahon, people without a whole lot of experience. The people who do have experience, someone like John McKinney, say, we see in a most recent Q poll, he just doesn't have very much statewide name recognition. It gets back to something we've talked about an awful lot, that I think a lot of people who work at the State House in Hartford think people know who they are and what they do quite a bit more than they actually do. Colin, I'll ask you, and then maybe the senator can chime in. What does the Republican Party do about that? I don't know if it's necessarily about ideology. It's just sort of about having some sort of a brand, some sort of names, some sort of people who might inspire and get people to pay attention to them.
Yeah, you know, I've been thinking a little bit about this, and I don't know the answer to this. But one thing I've been wondering about is whether or not there's the Republicans have some built-in problems, all right? First of all, there are not that many of them. Second of all, the people like John McKinney are minority leaders who are just inherently less visible than, say, a Brendan Sharkey, you know, the Speaker of the House is. It's just harder to, you know, to really create visibility for yourself. So those are problems. But I also find myself wondering whether the Republicans who do exist are not engaging that well with their elected leaders. I mean, basically, you look at the results of that poll, you look at the probable results of the convention, and you think, well, it kind of doesn't matter who the Republican mayor of the largest Connecticut city to have a Republican mayor is. It kind of doesn't matter who the minority leader of the Senate is. You know, these guys are just somehow they're not visible, even to their own party. You look at the Q poll results, you look at the recognition numbers, it seems as though even Republicans don't know enough about John McKinney or Mark Boughton to make a decision about them or to have an opinion about them. You know, and I sort of wonder how that happens and how you fix it. And I don't think it's quite as acutely bad on the Democratic side, maybe because there's just more Democrats so that they can meet their leaders more often. But maybe there's a model that they have for engagement that the Republicans lack.
Dan Malloy's name recognition was not really much better than
True.
Boughton or McKinney at this point 4 years ago. So the question is, can Boughton and McKinney convince delegates that what the poll really shows is there's that the strong – that the generic Republican vote is within 5 points of Governor Malloy right now? That, you know, that Tom Foley's standing is based on name ID of him being the guy 4 years ago. And that's really their challenge to delegates to say, look, any Republican who has a decent organization, a good message, and can qualify for public financing will be competitive with this incumbent Democratic governor, who the polls show is very vulnerable.
But, Senator, for part of that strategy that Colin's talking about, wouldn't it really require the Republicans to come out of this convention with an opportunity for a robust debate between Tom Foley, Mark Bout, and John McKinney? I mean, if we just end up with a coronation of Tom Foley and we end up with him running against Dan Malloy over the course of the next several months, it doesn't seem like that's going to do anything for the party whatsoever.
Couldn't agree with you more. And the argument is going to be made that what is needed is a unified choice, a unified convention. Well, unified conventions have gotten the Republicans nowhere. No, they need a robust debate on the issues among the various candidates. And I think if they do that, they can bring themselves into the fore. Don't forget, I suspect most of the polls don't include all the Republicans who have left the Republican Party and become independent. I mean, independency is the biggest factor in the state of Connecticut. I suspect a large part of it are ex-Republicans who are fed up with what's gone on. So there's no question about the fact that if they can bring those people out by debating the issues, the party stands a real good chance of winning.
Danielle, just quickly, I wanted to ask you, that Tom Foley has been a little bit underground over the course of these last several months. He's allowed the other Republicans who are in the field to debate a number of times. He said he wasn't going to do that during the conventions. The only thing we've really heard from him or about him over the course of the last couple of weeks was a speeding ticket that he got the other day. I mean, from the standpoint of not just name recognition, but Tom Foley and how he's handled his front runner status so far. I mean, what do you make of this?
He's just kind of, sat back and let the others go at it, and, you know, as you pointed out, in a series of debates. I mean, I think the governor may be optimistic if he's hoping that what emerges from this convention is a thorough and deep and intelligent discussion of the issues. What happened last time was you had two guys tearing each other apart and laying the playbook for the Democrat to, you know, pick up the ball and run with it. So, I mean, you could have a three-way brawl on your hands with, you know, these three guys spending a couple months just, you know, going negative all the time.
These guys have been campaigning to 1,235 delegates, not to the general public. Governor Weicker, is it time to get rid of the convention structure and just begin the campaign talking to the electorate as opposed to talking to delegates?
I don't think there's any question about it. I think the delegates in both parties are professionals that sort of look for that one day when they're a big deal. We've got to live with the choices that they make, and those choices encompass all the problems and opportunities of the state. So absolutely, would I support a primary system rather than a convention system? Certainly would. As a matter of fact, if you recall, when I was in the Republican Party and the titular head, I tried to get independents to be able to vote in the Republican primary. And then as soon as I left, the Republicans tossed that rule out. But I got to tell you, in terms of the general election, now we're talking right now about what? We're talking about a convention or however many hundred delegates there are. Instead of the system talking to the millions or the state of Connecticut and making a choice that could win a general election, never mind a convention.
You know, the thing that I keep thinking is, and is that over the last few weeks, the Democrats and Dan Malloy, they're almost like a boxer who keeps dropping his gloves, and the opponent never really takes a swing at him. You know, we've seen the complete collapse of Dan Malloy's, the Malloy administration's plan to finance the state. In other words, we've gone from, you know, a large deficit to a tiny little deficit. All kinds of things have had to be kind of rolled back as a result of that. And that's just the beginning.
Surplus, you'll say. Yes.
Yeah.
You said deficit, but
oh, so
we mean surplus.
Sorry,
yes, absolutely. Yeah.
See, I'm already confused.
Yeah.
But so the deficit shrank down to almost nothing. I mean, all this stuff happened. The rebate had to be canceled, all this stuff. Really, the most vocal opponent that Dan Malloy has had is Larry Caffaro, who's not running for governor. It's kind of astonishing the degree to which Foley, McKinney, Boughton, these are opportunities for big press conferences making a lot of noise. And I'm not saying they didn't say anything about it. But they I think Paz is right. I think they're talking to delegates right now instead of the public. And I think that's a mistake. I think this is your opportunity to seize a certain amount of ground and say, wow, Malloy's stuff, it really doesn't work all that well. He hasn't really been telling us the truth about the numbers.
Well, and as we found with Tom Foley, I mean, when he announced what he did was this weird series of allegations about corruption around Dan Malloy, which were proven to be false or he couldn't find any information. He spent quite a bit of time, Paz, talking about things that maybe wouldn't resonate with anybody about Dan Malloy. But right now, we're going to talk about it again tomorrow. The fact is he promised that we were going to have a state surplus that would allow for a tax rebate and would allow for us to do some other things. And that just vanished. It's clear that his assumptions about the state of the economy were wrong. If I'm Tom Foley, I might say something about that, you know?
You might. He's again, he's been underground. And it's all focused on delegates.
You don't know anything. Do you not literally underground this entire time?
No.
Okay.
Although I like the idea. I like the image.
There's a bunker down there. But I guess I'm wondering why. Why has he been underground? Okay, talking to delegates and trying to do things behind closed doors. The governor is making, an eloquent point here.
It's a front-runner strategy. He's the front-runner for the Republican nomination. I think that's his near-term goal. And then his plan is he then pivots to face Dan Malloy. And there is time for that. I mean, the general public is not engaged really in the election right now. It is early. I mean, we all are consumed by it, but there is time. So to the extent Tom Foley has a plan, I believe that's what it is. It's the classic front runner strategy. I'm not going to engage these other guys for the nomination. I'm going to get past the end of May and then see what the terrain looks like. Do I have a primary? Do I not? And then go on from there.
Let's go to John in Kensington. And if you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Hi, John. Go ahead.
I think they put Tom Foley on ice because he had such a hard time getting out of the starter's box. But my comment was going to be, to Colin's point, Republicans have gravitated away from people coming up through the ranks to self-funders. And I think it's just because of the ability to raise money. They've been willing to take candidates like a Linda McMahon and a Tom Foley who could say, I'll run and I'll fund myself so you don't have to worry about the money. Takes all the pressure off. And I think that's why they're not taking, people like McKinney and it speaks well because you say, I'm not a politician and my other habits are good.
John
plays well and it's easy.
John, thank you very much. Senator Weicker, before I let you go, we got a tweet from Nancy here. She says the problem for Republicans is that they're all suspected of needing to keep in lockstep with ridiculous ideology once they're elected. That's one thing that maybe happens with Republicans at the national level more than at the state level. But her point is I think the one that you were trying to make at the beginning of the conversation.
Yeah, we're translating national policy into Connecticut. And Connecticut is an entirely different state with its own demographic. And that's what's not being addressed. Incidentally, John, your caller, I couldn't agree with him more. The only thing you have right now are self-funders. But it's ideas that are eventually going to go ahead and win. So there's no point in adopting any Republican national strategy. It just won't work in Connecticut or North, for that matter, in New England.
Lowell Weicker is Connecticut's former governor and U.S. senator. Thank you so much, sir, for joining us. I appreciate it.
It's good to be with all of you.
Also joining me today in the wheelhouse, Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR, Daniela Altamari, who is the State House reporter for the Hartford Courant, Mark Pazniokas, Capitol Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror. We'll take some more of your phone calls when we come back, 860-275-7266. And as we head to break, here's some music by the guy Republicans will be competing with at Mohegan Sun this weekend. Yeah, the GOP convention is, well, it's competing with the boss. Here's a song I think he wrote about the last night of Connecticut's legislative session. That's what we'll be talking about next, Where We Live.
Crazy.
This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. It's The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. You can join us as always, 860-275-7266. If you have some thoughts about this week in the news, especially what we've learned about the end of the state legislative session, now that we've had a week to digest it all. Joining me, as usual, in studio is Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Can you tell us what's on the program today, Colin?
I can tell you what's on the program. It's our salute to children's literature. It's sort of that time of the year. I think it's Children's Literature Week or Month. We'll talk a little bit especially about the fact that kids thirst for kind of dark themes in literature, all the kinds of children's literature that school boards are always banning. That's what kids really want.
Kids really want that. So kids' books this afternoon at 1 o'clock on the Colin McEnroe Show. Mark Pazniokas is here. He's the Capital Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror, writing, I believe, your own children's picture book. I'm sure it's going to be fabulous, Paz.
My children read about politics.
I'm sure they do. They're older, though, aren't they?
They are.
Danielle Altamari is a State House reporter for the Hartford Courant, and she writes for the Capital Watch blog. Again, you can join us, 860-275-7266. We're going to turn our attention now to the end of the state legislative session. Something we discussed at some length last week. As always, there's a lot of last-minute activity and horse trading. But Colin and I thought that a case study might be in order. So allow me to read from a story written that very night by our own Mark Pazniokas. The story begins, a House GOP filibuster on a bill imposing a three-year moratorium on the disposal in Connecticut of waste generated by fracking, a method of natural gas extraction, was resolved through a trade that discomfited some environmentalists. It required lifting a statutory ban on fishing for glass eels, a vulnerable species. The House voted 92-52 to lift the statutory ban, but the establishment of a fishery is contingent on approval by the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission. The interstate agency regulates the taking of glass eels, which are juvenile translucent American eels that can command prices of $2,000 a pound. Yes, that really happened in the state legislature. And before Colin gets to comment on it, can you tell us any, can you flesh this out a little bit more, trading fracking waste for glass eels?
Happens all the time in the last night or two. And covering the legislature in the last night, it's really like trying to decode a puzzle. You know that what they're doing or what they're not doing is connected to one, two, three, four, five other things. And the game that every reporter tries to play is, okay, how do you connect those dots? And I will confess to a small matter of pride that I did connect
the
dots.
You broke
the glass eels. I got it, baby.
I saw him on the stairs around 9:30 at night, and he had it. But see, this was preceded by something else. All three of us were there. I was sort of parachuted obnoxiously at the end of the session, but they actually worked there. And so what happened was, pretty unexpectedly, the Republicans in the House started to filibuster the fracking waste bill. And it went on for hours and hours. And suddenly we thought, oh, and see, one of the problems, of course, is the Democratic leadership. They leave everything to the last minute. So the Republicans, who numerically have no power whatsoever, wind up having quite a bit of power because all they have to do is talk long enough to make it impossible for the Democrats to do all of the things that they have on their to-do list. And that's exactly what was happening, and that was how glass eels, about which I would like to talk a little bit in just a second, came into play.
Well, and we're going to talk about glass eels because I want to find out a little bit more about this. But Daniela, so this is sort of the order of business, and we see this every time. Is it getting harder or easier after all these years for people like you and Paz to decode all of this stuff? Because, again, we pay a little bit of attention throughout the course of a long or, in this case, a short legislative session to bills that people have proposed. We try to gauge whether or not this is the right time for something to pass. And then also to just stuff happens at the end that seems disconnected in any way from what we may have talked about during the previous months.
Well, and this year you had a particular good example of that. I mean, in the 3 days leading up to the end of the session, you had hours and hours spent in the state Senate of these long and rather uninteresting congratulatory speeches. I mean, it was like the worst Oscar telecast ever, where they were just patting each other on the back constantly.
Did you see this year's Oscars? It was pretty bad. But anyway, please continue.
I mean, and the clothes were worse at the state Senate than they were at the Oscars.
Were they taking selfies, obnoxious selfies that they were posting on Twitter? I think they were, but anyway.
The whole day was one big
yeah. It was. I mean, it was just one big long kiss to each other. And it just, you know, if anybody was paying attention, it just really reinforced sort of some of the just gross aspects of government. So a lot of important bills, including a bill that passed the House on a wide bipartisan margin and got jammed up in the Senate again, even though it had, you know, a lot of bipartisan support. And this is a juvenile justice bill that has been, you know, a couple of years in the making. It needs to be done apparently to so the state will comply with some U.S. Supreme Court rulings. That, once again, the calendar ran out on that and or the clock ran out. And I think a lot of people were kind of angry because, you know, the state Senate could find the time, you know, to spend, you know, 2-3 hours every day, 4 hours every day, you know, saying goodbye to their, you know, clubby little insiders, and yet they couldn't get the work done that they needed to get done. So I think there was a lot of anger about that.
And this was a bill that one of our callers brought up last week. Again, something that for quite some time, not just advocates, but many people at the Capitol have actually been saying, this is really important. This isn't just a little piece of legislation that's going to go out for a constituent and make somebody happy. This is actually to keep the state in compliance with federal law.
Yes, and it's proposed by the bipartisan or nonpartisan Connecticut Sentencing Commission, made up of, you know, judges and lawyers and defense attorneys and prosecutors and police and all kinds of people. And what it does is, it, in a nutshell, it would comply with this U.S. Supreme Court ruling that says that people who are sentenced for crimes that they commit at a young age aren't sent away forever and ever. And they would have the chance, not a guarantee, but the chance to seek a, you know, seek parole. And that's all it would do. And some Republicans in the Senate were opposed to it. It passed the House with, you know, I think 15 no votes. It was very, very strong support. But anyway, you know, there was no time for that because there were two, you know, they spent too much time on these congratulatory speeches.
It also had 22 Republican amendments on it.
Yeah.
And a deal being offered because Sunday deer hunting is, it's like the Ventnor Avenue of legislation. Every year you can trade it for something. And so this year, that, at one point, that trade was being floated around too. Give us Sunday deer hunting and you can have juvenile justice.
And I think there was a shortstop involved.
Yeah.
Well, but let's just be clear about this. So in part, Paz, what Danielle is saying is, well, the Democrats wait too long and then they give each other these goodbye speeches, right, and we don't have time.
God help me. I'm going to defend the Senate Democratic leadership.
Go ahead.
To a tiny degree. If they hadn't done those tributes, I'm not sure they still would have got to this. Again, the end of the session is one long negotiation. It's what you can negotiate to the point that there's no Republican filibuster opposition. That's what goes. They didn't clear that hurdle with the juvenile sentencing bill, which was now to fault them, they could have taken it up earlier. Mm-hmm. I mean, that did not have to wait to the last week when the Republicans have extreme control. But this, the whole point of legislation by negotiation, on the last night, the Senate passed on a consent calendar, you know, upwards of 70 bills. The legislature as a whole did more business on the last day than they had done in the previous 12 weeks and 6 days of the session. Danielle is right to the point that they could have taken it up earlier. And if you don't do it, if you do it before the last 3 days, the Republicans don't have veto power. And they just let this one slide by. And I think that's what we can really fault them for.
But I think what a lot of Democrats will say, you know, they'll say exactly what Colin just said, which there are a lot of an important bill. There are a lot of Republican amendments to this bill. It's not just the Democrats dawdling or not, you know, deciding that they're going to run the calendar,
the
right?
Republicans thought the bill went beyond where it needed to go to comply with the court rulings. That was Senator McKinney's take. You know, you can debate whether that's, you know, accurate or not. The other issue here is this isn't something that's going to lead to complete chaos with thousands of inmates facing early release or being able to go to court to have something overturned. It's a relatively small number of folks who were sentenced as juveniles to these, in effect, life sentences.
Or just really, I mean, sometimes it is the 15-year-old kid who was in the back seat of the car the night one of the guys in the front seat killed somebody. You wind up with, you know, maybe a 45, 50, 60-year sentence. And even if he's demonstrating the ability to rehabilitate himself or the instinct to rehabilitate himself, he still can't get a parole hearing. I mean, it really is pretty tragic that they couldn't get this done.
There's a case before the Connecticut Supreme Court. It's somebody who got a 100-year sentence. And that, you know, so the Connecticut Supreme Court may force the legislature next year to do something, depending what they do with this case. We'll see how broadly they rule.
We're talking about some of the things that did and didn't make it into the last night of the legislative session, which ended last week, but it's taken this long for us to sort of figure out everything that's in there. We're talking with Mark Pasniokas of the Connecticut Mirror, Daniela Altamari from the Hartford Courant, and also Colin McEnroe from WNPR. We'll take your calls in a moment at 860-275-7266. But before we move too far from the horse trading or the eel trading that was going on that last night, Colin, this glass eel something is actually something you know something about. And this isn't just a throwaway kind of a funny little story that we can put on about how the legislature doesn't work. There's actually some real stuff here.
Yeah, it's a crazy story. And so just a quick sort of primer about eels. Eels start their life in rivers, and then they go to spawn in the Sargasso Sea. After they've spawned in the Sargasso Sea, the young eels come back, and they go up these freshwater rivers in America. Now, they are prized in overseas markets. Basically, they're shipped to China, raised in ponds, and then they become sushi. And for that reason, I think Paz's article said 2,000. I've seen prices in previous years as high as $2,600 a pound for these. So they're basically the cocaine of edible marine life. And they do attract a comparable clientele. I mean, there are up in Maine where for some reason or other is the Medellin of eels. I mean, there are like armed confrontations. There are poachers shooting at one another. There are El Salvadoran drug cartels showing. I mean, the whole thing has gone completely insane. But because of that, and also because of dams and all the other things that create predation on life, eels are very, very endangered. They probably will be declared internationally endangered within the next year or two. So starting a fishery right now doesn't really make a lot of sense to me.
It seems maybe going in the opposite direction of where Connecticut normally would go, Paz.
You would think. the case for lifting the statutory ban is it gives Connecticut a shot at an allocation that's set by the Atlantic Marine Fisheries Commission of, you know, it's an interstate compact of which Connecticut belongs. And presumably they will say whether any fish can be safely taken. But yeah, Mary Mashinsky, one of the longtime environmentalists in the House, made essentially Colin's point saying, look, we're going to have a lot more data in the next year or two about whether this species should be on the endangered list. Why in God's name are we doing this now? Well, we know why.
Let's go to the phones. Brian's calling from New Haven. Hey there, Brian. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just wondering if Mary Mashinsky or anybody up there in the legislature, even you guys, might comment on the endangered species called human beings that will be happening eventually, I guess, based on the Times article of a couple of days ago, which I forget what the lead group was that investigated, but NASA thought it was good enough to chime in and saying that the Antarctic ice sheets and, Antarctica is basically melting, and the term past the point of no return was used in the article, which was alarming. But I think it's sort of trumps about every issue on the table. So
hey, Brian, I'm glad you raised that. This is something Colin and I have been talking about in the newsroom quite a bit, and I think we're both looking at having full-length conversations about climate change coming up. This is something that is alarming. It's something that is clearly, scientists say, happening right now and will have true impacts on us, not just in the decades to come, but in the months and years ahead. This is something that the Connecticut State Legislature really isn't talking about at all as they trade glass eels for fracking waste.
No, they would tell you that they are. They would tell you, and I'm sure Daniela and Paz can amplify this quite a bit, but they would tell you, for example, maybe that the CRRA legislation that they looked at this year, converting it from trash burning towards recycling, is a significant step. Governor Malloy would tell you that within his administration, they're doing all kinds of wonderful things in terms of energy conservation, especially in terms of how the state itself actually operates. But so much of it depends on your point of view. I share the caller's point of view. This is a much more urgent situation. Small steps aren't really going to be enough. And obviously, it's an international problem. Connecticut can't solve it on its own. But I would agree that it wasn't treated with any real urgency in this session.
Daniela, any thoughts on this?
Well, I agree. I mean, it dwarfs everything, right? So, but in some ways, maybe that's, part of the reason why. I mean, what can you do? You can't pass legislation in the middle of the night saying, we're going to ban climate change. I mean, it's just too big.
You could trade it for something else, though, Paz. I mean, Colin makes a point. I think the Malloy administration certainly says that their energy plan is moving us away from dirty burning fuels into cleaner burning fuels. There's a lot that's been done over the course of the last couple of years. lawmakers in Connecticut and the Northeast, by and large, has been a leader on this front. But it is something that seems to be staring us squarely in the face as we congratulate ourselves and pat ourselves on the back about all the other great things that we're doing.
Connecticut is one of the states that did take issue with the Midwestern states and are trying to force, you know, with the EPA, force those Midwestern states that rely heavily on coal to back off on that, although that goes more to air quality as opposed to climate change and global warming. The legislature, they can play a very small role on the climate issue. They can play a larger role on the mitigation issue of how do you respond. And they're not great on that either. And by mitigation, I mean what do you do in coastal Connecticut? What do you allow for development? How good a job are you doing in preserving marshes that act as sponges and so forth?
The term is adaptation. It's really looking at ways in which we can adapt to the fact that this is happening and make sure that we're able to protect our property, protect our business interests, and everything else along the way. I guess I thought as the caller was talking, Colin, about something at the beginning of the session. As we talk about jobs here in Connecticut, which is, of course, a very important thing, you know, Vermont's governor said, we're going to talk for an entire State of the State speech about the heroin problem in our state, because I see this as something that we just need to start a discussion about. It's here. It's real. We need to do something about it. I'm not saying that the heroin problem in Vermont or climate change for the globe are in any way similar. But the point is that one of the things that lawmakers can do, whether or not you're in the executive branch or the legislative branch, is to set the tone for what's the thing that really matters. Maybe it's climate change. Maybe it's heroin in our communities. But are we setting the right tone?
Yeah, certainly watching this session, you would not conclude that climate change was an issue that, as Daniela said, dwarfs everything. I mean, that tone wasn't there in Governor Malloy's speech and it wasn't there in the activities of the legislature. And I would just add to that, I mean, there are, in terms of the adaptation question, there's a fascinating array of issues with the adaptation question. Agriculturally, there's going to have to be a tremendous amount of adaptation. And you know, I mean, Connecticut has farms. They're going to have to figure out some of this stuff too. So, yeah, I don't know. Tone setting, no, that didn't happen.
The one thing they did do along these lines was they did come up with money to sort of close the deal on the purchase of the preserve, this 1,000-acre mm-hmm. forest in coastal Connecticut. You know, overall, in the global sense, it's a small thing, but you know, for Connecticut, it was a decent step.
That's
forward.
A good thing, yeah. Maybe
when we come back, we'll talk about a few other things that were good about the session, some other things that maybe weren't so good about the session, some winners and losers. Colin's also been talking with a Republican in the state legislature who's maybe some ideas about how these things can change. We'll also take a listen to a new DECD ad trying to tout the state's job creators, trying to figure out whether or not that's political speech or not. We'll find that out with Colin McEnroe, Daniela Altomare, and Mark Pazniokas here in the Wheelhouse on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, promises, promises, promises. All politicians make them, but they don't always keep them. Just last month, Governor Daniel Malloy canceled his $55 tax rebate that he'd promised residents earlier this year. On the next Where We Live, a panel of experts will give us an in-depth look at the power of political rhetoric, what happens when politicians fail to keep their word. We'll even talk with some behavioral scientists about how this all works on the brain. It's coming up tomorrow on Where We Live. Today, it's The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. Colin McEnroe from The Colin McEnroe Show, heard 1 o'clock on each and every weekday on WNPR, is here with us. Daniela Altomare, who writes for the Capitol Watch blog and is a State House reporter for the Hartford Current. And Mark Pazniokas, who is Capitol Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror. Quickly, let's go through some things in the last couple of minutes. Colin, I know you had an interesting conversation with a Republican in the state legislature who, like you, has been calling for some change in the way business is done.
Yes. I mean, Joe Markley and I have very little in common politically. I mean, he's one of the most conservative guys up there. But like me and like a lot of people, he's really kind of appalled by the way that they do business. His big thing is the so-called implementer. Just to quickly sketch this out for those of you who don't live and breathe this stuff, the implementer is actually a bunch of bills or a bill that implements the budget. It's supposed to just provide the technical language that makes the budget happen. However, over the years, it's just become this potpourri of amendments and added language that has to do with all kinds of things that have never had public hearings and stuff like that. And I think with 14 minutes left to go in the session this year, Markley stood up and said something like, I could talk for 14 minutes. I'm not going to do that. I won't do it to you, but I could talk for 14 minutes. And he said, I'm not promising that I won't do that next year. And you know, he just wants to – he thinks it's – he was a legislator 30 years ago when, in fact, that process was quite a bit cleaner than it is today. He doesn't like that. He doesn't like all the emergency certifications. He doesn't – you know, I mean, he wants to have an intervention. He says the first step is admitting you have a problem. And so I said, look, if you can get those people to admit that they have a problem, I'll join the Tea Party. But he wants to do it, and you know, Godspeed to him. I mean, I hope he you know, finds some open ears.
Any chance of it changing?
I would write about both those things.
Yeah. But any chance of any of this changing
no.
the way business is done? It's
no.
just no. It's human, heading in one direction.
It's human nature. It's again, it's wheeling and dealing. Connecticut's process is not the worst, but it's not the best either. But it's what legislators do. It's the implementer. The beauty of the implementer is it must pass. So therefore, if you can tuck into it whatever little thing you need, you want, you're home free. It will go. And that is a very alluring thing at the Capitol. I really don't see these guys ever backing away from it because it benefits both parties.
There is a lot of sense, though, in the idea, Daniela, that we would have an implementer that would just implement the budget, that you could just pass a law that says you just can't tuck anything else in there. Yes, we know that the lawmakers would have to pass that law in the first place, but do you see any popular uprising about this? Anybody willing to challenge this notion?
No, I think Paz is right. I mean, do the people know or care? I mean, I don't think so. It's just the way things are done, and so lawmakers are just going to continue to do
it. And there was
it.
A little reform actually tucked in there, something that the leadership refused to take up, which was changing this crazy pension system for the judges where mm-hmm. you can be on the bench for 2 years, and when you turn 70, you get a $100,000 pension. Larry Caffaro, one of the things he insisted in return for peace was you got to change that. You got to reduce those pensions proportionally for each year that you don't serve 10 years. So the irony is you had a reform thing that was done through, you know, less than clean means.
Yeah.
I just want to ask, any other bills that came out of this session, now that we know all what happened at the end of the session, that were actually good pieces of legislation for Connecticut, some things that were interesting to you, Daniela?
Well, I think the one that Paz just mentioned was definitely one of them. They couldn't get it done in sort of the regular way, so it got in that way. I remember at the beginning of the session, we were talking to the leaders, and they said, this is going to be, you know, the consumer session. This is going to be the year when we tackle, you know, consumer-friendly bills. And they did do some things. Honestly, it's such a blur. Sometimes I can't remember if they passed both chambers or not. But I know there was a proposal to prevent companies from texting you, so that texting, basically you could put your texting on the do not call list, so you wouldn't be bothered. And I think that passed. Pharmacy rewards, privacy for that, because you're giving up some of your medical privacy if you sign up for those. I'm not sure if that passed or not, but those were the types of things that they did.
The electric retail business, the protection bill did pass. Yeah. AARP, which was one of the big backers, was not entirely happy with it. It's a big transparency bill. It requires a lot of disclosure on your bill so you can compare. But you still must do the work, and you must figure out if you're getting a good deal or not.
We got a tweet from Amanda who says, hey, at least they passed unanimously in the Senate a tree trimming bill, albeit a weak one. These are the parentheses are hers, not mine, that sheds light on the overly aggressive trimming by UI and CLMP.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people who really care about the status of the trees. Look, we just have a couple minutes left, and I want to talk about one other thing that happened this week. Some new TV ads are touting Connecticut's economy. The campaign is called Meet the Job Creators. It features companies like Jackson Laboratories and NBC Sports. Let's listen.
Meet the real job creators.
We're designing medicine based on your DNA.
We're keeping U.S. manufacturing moving forward.
We consolidated our operations right here.
In Connecticut.
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 Because so many breakthroughs are happening right here.
Because we can compete with China and Mexico from here.
Because it's easy to get anywhere from here.
Join the growing businesses building their future in Connecticut. Visit ctforbusiness.com.
I love the idea that it's easy to get anywhere from here. Have you ever tried to drive to Providence, Rhode Island from Hartford? But anyway.
That's not anywhere.
So that, now, we've got listeners in Rhode Island. Colin, these ads have been criticized a bit because some Republicans are saying, look, it's a campaign year. They're essentially political ads for Daniel Malloy. What do we think?
Yeah, they should be criticized. I mean, look, it walks like a duck. It swims like a duck. It quacks like a duck. And I mean, the real question is, where are these campaign ads being run? If they're being run in Connecticut, well, that's kind of ridiculous. I mean, there's no reason to run them in Connecticut other than to create an atmosphere of self-congratulation. This is a now time-honored and disgraceful tradition that goes dates back to John Roland's tourism ads featuring John and Patty Roland.
In a canoe.
Jody Rell, of course, did all these public service announcements with her own voice telling us to buckle our seatbelts and don't run with scissors and all this kind of stuff. Susan Bisewitz was the lady in red telling us how to use the new voting machines in TV commercials. I could go on. It just never stops. And it ought to stop. I mean, it is the use of taxpayer money to fund TV commercials that are essentially political in nature.
Of the $569,000 buy, $42,000, I think, is in Connecticut. But there's no question that anything that creates an environment, that creates – promotes a sense that things are happening here accrues to the benefit of Dan Malloy. I mean, that is an essential part of his reelection message. He'll talk about – the deal he cut with United Technologies to solidify Connecticut's hold on the state's largest private employer. I mean, the ads, they are this sort of up with people kind of tone. They are mainly running in New York. I tried to find out if any of it's going on the air in New York, because if you do that, you're also advertising to Fairfield County. The initial buy I got, it seemed to be all cable, but I'm going to keep an open mind until I see all the data on that.
Do we know anything more about that, Daniela? Because, again, buying New York media market means buying Fairfield County.
Yeah, and buying the attention of voters down there. So,
of course, the rest of the money being spent in New York, the idea is this is a place to come bring jobs, bring business.
The hard copy I got, it was all cable for New York. And what I could not pin down the other day was, is that the complete buy? And, you know, the governor's office never got back to me on that final point. So
I think one last point to you, though, Colin, is interesting. As the ad ends, it has the tagline at the end, still revolutionary. This is still here. Still revolutionary is how we're selling jobs in the state. It's how we're selling tourism. It's still tacked on to everything.
Although Governor Malloy promised you, I think, that it would also include the sexual revolution. I still haven't seen those billboards. I don't want to see those billboards.
I was looking for the billboards about the sexual revolution. Those have never yet come.
It could cause accidents.
Those may be post-election election billboards. Do you think, Colin, that this ad campaign, tying in an ad campaign about what makes Connecticut great with an ad campaign about jobs here, with the sort of tourism for people to spend money within the state, that this all ties together in some sort of coherent way?
I'm going to say I think it, to a certain degree, it does. And I think actually this is something that you can give Governor Malloy some credit for, that he really has spruced up the image of this state. And there's some substance behind this sprucing up. They're running around, you know, to various far-flung locales pursuing business. I mean, it's not all smoke and mirrors anyway. And anyway, you need some smoke and mirrors, and that's what all these ads are.
Yeah.
Jody Rell's last year, there was a dollar for marketing. And
we got kicked out of New England.
We got kicked out of New England for not paying our dues. That's right.
And all the data shows that marketing is a good investment. It really does, you know, it really does make a difference. Colorado, they stopped advertising for similar reasons, budget few years ago, and their tourism suffered. So, you know, we can make fun of it, but there is a value to it.
But Colorado passed legalized marijuana, and so now it's all good there. We didn't even get a chance to talk about the Q poll and legalization of marijuana. Maybe that's for next time. I want to thank Mark Pazniokas, Capital Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror. Thanks so much, Paz.
Going to go have those eels.
Thanks to Daniela Altomare, State House reporter for the Hartford Current. Thank you, Daniela.
Thanks.
And thanks to Colin McEnroe, host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR.
Thank you, Mr. Dankowski.
I also want to thank our great intern, Elton Thomas, who spent the last month or so with us. Thank you so much, Elton. It's his last day. Appreciate all the work that you did here. Our program is produced by Tucker Ives, Lydia Brown, and Katie Talarski. We're still revolutionary, and this is where we live.